And first, congratulations for being here on Saturday morning in beautiful Santa Barbara area. And I see a hope for deep Earth research, especially for the study of the Earth's core, since you are all here. And so today, both lectures in the morning will be focusing on the Earth's core. And the Earth's core is important for the boundary layers because it actually involves two boundaries, two important boundaries, the inner core boundary and the core mantle boundary. Just to give you a review of what we have been doing for mineral physics part. So we have had the overview, transition zone, and spin lower mantle, and then the experimental roundup, two tutorials. So this is the one on mineral physics of the Earth's core. Later on, Bob Lieberman is going to come talk about elasticity of mantle minerals, and then there is a talk by Abby and me on transport properties. And finally, Abby is going to talk about the boundaries and the interfaces. So that's how the mineral physics part is going to go. So the Earth's core. The Earth has a liquid outer core, which starts from 2,900 kilometers to 5,150 kilometers. This is about as thick as the lower mantle, and they are the thickest layers in the Earth's interior. And if you look at the volume fraction, the outer core is about 15% of the Earth's interior, and its mass fraction is almost one-third. So this is a very significant reservoir inside of the Earth, and it's totally molten. And then we have a inner core. Inner core has actually a considerable thickness, but the volume and the mass fraction is very small. It's less than 1% in volume, and it's just about 1% in mass. Although it's very tiny, it may have very important implications for the dynamics of the Earth. And the discovery of the Earth, I'm sure our ancestors have speculated about the existence of a dense region inside of the Earth maybe a long time ago, but the real discovery of the core is only about 100 years ago. In 1906, Oldham, he observed a low velocity region inside of the Earth based on the magnitude of compressional wave. So basically it's the attenuation that indicates the existence of low velocity region, that's the Earth's core. And now you can see that the Earth's outer core, because it's liquid and because it has very low velocity, it casts a shadow zone, a very wide shadow zone, in the S wave, and also a shadow zone in the P wave. But if you, because the inner core is solid again, so you see the reappearance of the P wave over this region within the shadow zone. So this is the basis of discovery of the inner core in 1936 by Lehman. So the discovery of the core is only a century old. And then over this century, people have been studying the core from many different disciplines, including seismology, which gives the ground truth of the core, what's the density and the velocity profile, and also the wave, compressional wave anisotropy, which indicates the wave traveling along the long equatorial direction and the polar direction, they have slight difference in velocity. And then more recently, people have already started to produce tomography in the Earth's core, mostly near the inner core boundary and the core mantle boundary. And the geochemistry and the cosmochemistry, this is another branch that gives us observational data on the Earth's core. For instance, the implications for what is in the core, what's the chemical composition of the core, and how did the core form? How does the whole core form? How does the inner core form? That's based on both observational and experimental geochemistry and cosmochemistry data. And then a few days ago, Catherine talked about magnetic field observation, which tell us about the convection, the dynamics of the core. And then I think later on, Bruce is going to talk about the geodynamics, the convection in the liquid core, and also thermal evolution of the core, how it affects the whole dynamic of the Earth's interior, including the mantle overlying the core. In the mineral physics, this is a link that try to make sense of all these observational data. So when we see the seismic velocity density, all these data, we want to know what are the materials that have these kind of properties. We also want to know what's the temperature of the Earth's core. You know, if you there's no way to really directly measure temperature, so you have to observe the properties and try to use property material property data to infer what is the thermal and the chemical properties of the Earth's core. So one important thing is the inner core boundary. This boundary is of particular importance because it gives us a constraint on temperature, on geotherm. So we know that the outer core, as it cools, in the beginning, presumably it was totally molten. As the Earth cools, then gradually we have the appearance of the inner core from the center of the Earth. And this fact, usually people take it for granted, the inner core grows from the center. But there is a reason behind that, and that's because the adiabat, which is the temperature gradient in the convecting liquid core, it intersects with the melting temperature of the core. If we assume the melting the core is totally made of iron, then the melting temperature of iron has this kind of slope. It increases with the melting temperature increases with pressure. The adiabat also increases with pressure, but these two has different slopes. So it turns out that the melting temperature has a steeper slope than the adiabat. So the adiabat in the beginning is probably at a higher temperature. So yesterday when we had exercise, we talked about a foot temperature and temperature gradient. So the foot temperature in the beginning might be higher here. As the core cools, it moves gradually down here. And then at some point, it's going to intersect with the melting temperature. Because of the relationship in the slope, the intersection is going to be at a high pressure end. So the Earth's core starts to, inner core starts to grow from the center and gradually moves outwards. Right now, it's only about 1% of the whole, it's about 4% of the core and about 1% of the whole Earth. So these kind of relationship tells us if we want to know the temperature at the inner core boundary, we just have to know what the core is made of and what is the melting temperature of that material. And we always try to start with the simplest model. Very early on, we already have that idea the core is mainly made of iron nickel alloy. And for simplification, we actually can focus on melting of iron. That's why mineral physics people have focused lots of efforts on determining the melting temperature of iron as a function of pressure. So I have two diagrams showing, summarizing the results we have so far. It may not be totally comprehensive, but that's the most updated information I have. So this one shows the experimental data based on static experiments. So we have two sets of measurements we can do. One is to using high pressure apparatus at a static compression condition. The other is to use a shockwave. So this diagram only shows the static compression data. Temperature as a function of pressure, and we see that this is the pure iron at the low pressure. It has a BCC phase. As pressure increases, it becomes a HCP phase. There's also a question about whether there is a beta phase forming over here, but this one hasn't been, no consensus hasn't been reached. And if you increase the temperature, the alpha phase will transform to gamma phase, which is FCC iron. And then if you increase temperature even further at the low temperature, it transforms to delta phase, which is actually BCC phase. It's because these two phases are separated by gamma phase, we give it a different name called delta phase. These two phases have the same structure. But these regions are the very low pressure, so not really relevant to the Earth's core. And when you increase temperature further, then iron starts to melt. And this is the melting curve over here. But what you see is there are a lot of uncertainty in the melting curve. This is data from Bowler et al. This melting curve is the lowest. And then we have data by Saxena et al. Dashed lines, and then Shen et al., Ma, and Ma et al., these are the solid lines. So there is quite a big difference. If you look at 100, let's say 200 GPA, data do not reach over here. But if you extrapolate to this region, I think the uncertainty can be easily 500 degrees. And that is because when you do, all these data are in diamond anvil cell using laser heating. And there is significant uncertainty in temperature and also some uncertainty in pressure that causes these kind of discrepancy. Another important discrepancy is how do you tell something melts when you are in a diamond amber cell? The sample is very small. People use different ways. They can look at the fluid motion. Once the melt starts to move around, the reflectivity is going to change. The structure is going to change. So you can look at X-ray diffraction pattern. So you can use different criteria, and not all of them agree with each other. So that also introduces uncertainty in the melting temperature. And this melting temperature directly translated into the uncertainty in the ICB, the temperature at ICB. Yesterday when we did the tutorial, people were asking, what is a good range for the foot temperature at ICB? And I said it's 5,500 plus minus 1,000, right? So I gave a relatively wide range because if you really look at the condition, measurements carried out at the ICB boundary pressure, there are only shockwave experiments available. And then each individual measurement has large uncertainties. So this uncertainty is about 1,000 degrees. And then between different experiments, U et al. And then Brown and McQueen, you can also see there are large uncertainties between different sets of measurements. So if we think the inner core is, or if you consider a simplified model of the iron core, then the melting temperature would be ranging by like plus minus 1,000 degrees. And then the average one would be the inner core temperature. Here, if you read off this one, probably it says 6,000 degree K at the inner core boundary. So mineral physics can tell us the temperature at the inner core boundary through study of the melting temperature of iron. And somebody asked about nickel, because we know almost for sure that besides iron, we also have nickel in the core. So how does nickel affect the melting temperature of iron? Unfortunately, there are not many data existing for to study effect of nickel on melting temperature of iron. We do have some studies, for instance, this one, showing how the phase diagram of nickel looks like compared with iron. So all these curves are for iron. You have the BCC phase, FCC, and HCP. When you add nickel to it, if you remember phase rule, when you have one component at a phase boundary, like say this boundary, you have two phase coexisting, FCC with HCP. But if you have we have two components adding nickel to it, then you would have these phase boundary kind of one boundary would expand into a region. So you would have two phase coexisting within these two boundaries. And then at each one phase boundary, you would have three phases coexisting, because now you've added one component to it. So the number of coexisting phase has increased by one. So this is a nickel phase diagram. For some reason, mainly because of experimental challenge, they do not reach the melting temperature. They do see subsolidus phase relations when you add nickel. And this is a more recent data by Dubrinsky et al. Showing also this one, Abby actually mentioned it on the first day, about the presence of high pressure BCC phase. We know the BCC phase exists at a very low pressure, but at really high pressure, more than 200, about 240 GPa, these experimentalists found the BCC phase again. So that puts a question mark on what is really the stable structure of iron in the Earth's inner core. Is it HCP or BCC, or as some theoretical studies suggest, it could be even be FCC. So the question now is almost open again, although for a long time people almost accepted HCP is the stable phase. So again, in this study, you see that the experimental data do not quite reach the melting temperature. But at least they show by this temperature, iron nickel alloy hasn't melted yet. So this would be a lower bound for the melting temperature. Melting temperature has to be at least higher than that. So we don't know the effect of nickel on melting temperature of iron very well.
I have a question.
Yes?
Would it be possible to directly measure seismic wave speeds in like a diamond anvil cell?
In diamond anvil cell, compressional wave velocity is actually possible to measure. For instance, there is a study by Michael Brown's group. They're doing impulsive stimulated scattering. They could measure sound velocity directly by shining laser to the pulsed laser to the sample and trying to see how the scattered light interfere with each other, and then it gives you the sound velocity. And I think the ultrasonic velocity, they also have the similar principle. They were able to measure sound velocity directly in diamond anvil cell. But if you want to create the pressure temperature condition and measure all this velocity, then experimental is challenging. So the concept, the technique exists, but not able to reproduce the condition of the Earth's core. So now we have assumed that the Earth's core is just made of one component, pure iron. That's a very large simplification, because we know the Earth's core contains other elements. Especially, there are elements lighter than iron that may be very important for the properties and dynamics of the core. So how do we know about the existence of light elements in the core? So again, we come back to the ground truth from seismology, the PREM model. We have the density profile. So we recognize the starting point of the outer core based on the disappearance of VS. So VS all of a sudden drops to zero. And there's a density jump from about 5 to 10. It's almost a double density at the core mantle boundary. And the velocity also drops significantly from a relatively high velocity to a low velocity zone. This is a low velocity zone observed by Oldham more than 100 years ago. So this is the outer core. And then we have inner core, the reappearance of the VS, the density. There is a slight increase in density at the inner core boundary. And we also have a slight increase in velocity at the inner core boundary. So these are the data we have. Now, if we assume that the core is made of pure iron, we could compare the properties of iron with the core and see if they really match. Turns out they do not match, and there's a significant discrepancy. For one thing, the density deficit in the core has been known for, I think, more than 50, maybe more than 60 years. So this is the diagram illustrating this density deficit. You have iron at 7,000 K. These are not direct measurements, but we do, like from yesterday's exercise, probably you remember, you have the compression curve of iron. You have some information about it, thermal expansion coefficient. You could calculate iron, a density of iron at a certain pressure and a certain temperature. And this is the calculated curve. And then you can also have another set of measurements, that's shockwave measurements, measure the density along a Hugoniot, which is the adiabatic compression PT path. So you have these kind of data. If you compare the data with PREM, you can see that at the same pressure, the density of iron, even at high temperature, is higher than PREM by quite a lot. It's a 5 to 8% difference. And then the Hugoniot as well shows there's a discrepancy. And then that means that the core is too light compared with pure iron. Now, how do you correct for this difference? From this, people infer that the core has to contain light elements to reduce the density. And this discrepancy not only exists in the outer core, but also exists in the inner core. Although in the beginning, people thought, OK, the outer core needs light elements, the inner core is OK. If you take a closer look, the inner core also is not pure iron or iron nickel alloy. So, yes?
There's some differences between the Hugoniot and...
That's right.
So is that like the uncertainty that we have on...
The difference is partly because the Hugoniot is not isothermal, it's isentropic, right, more. So the temperature along the Hugoniot is not fixed. That's part of the reason. At the low pressure, the temperature of Hugoniot is lower, so the density would be higher. I think that uncertainty is not, how should we say that? It's expected uncertainty, it's not experimental uncertainty. Expected the difference between the isothermal density profile and the Hugoniot.
Right, yeah. And the uncertainty, the Hugoniot on those points are pressure density points that are very well constrained, but what's not known is the temperature at each of those points. So temperature is varying in a way that is not easily measured and difficult to infer. So, so it's neither isotherm nor an adiabat. It's just the pressure volume or the pressure density points that are reached during each shock experiment.
Right, it's usually estimated according to adiabatic temperature, but in reality it's a dynamic compression process. So temperature here would be lower and temperature here might be higher. So if you have a lower temperature, you have a higher density and the vice versa. So that would be the explanation. And when we look at the inner core, there is also a need for light elements, the presence of light elements. So this is a plot of sound velocity as a function of density. Normally there is a, in mineral physics, people usually refer to Birch's law. Birch's law describes how Vp increase linearly with density. So we make this kind of plot. And in this plot, what I show here is we have the inner core according to Prem. This is Vs, and this is Vp as a function of density. And then these different symbols, they are measurements on iron or iron nickel alloy. So for instance, over here you have the iron, the stars over here. So these iron measurements, you can see that there is a set of measurements over here. That's for the BCC iron. And we have HCP iron, a set of measurements over here. These measurements, they do follow Birch's law in the sense that the Vp increase linearly with density. But if you extrapolate it into the core, it actually almost just overlap with the inner core values, except for two complications. One is these measurements are conducted at the room temperature. So at high temperature, there are some measurements, for instance, epsilon iron. These data would fall down to over here. So if you extrapolate these guys, they do not match the inner core any longer. Another complication is you look at the slope over here. This one is not easy to the slope. But if you look at the slope, it's going to be much shallower than this slope. So it doesn't, the actual value at high temperature doesn't match. And then the gradient, how velocity change with density also doesn't match the inner core. So there are discrepancies between iron, pure iron and the inner core. And if you really want to match both velocity and density, so here the density of the core would be plotted over here. So you, when you match the velocity, the density doesn't match simultaneously. You do want to match both, right, in order to really account for the inner core based on pure iron model. So it doesn't work. And for Vs, the situation is even worse. So this is the density of inner core and the Vs of the inner core. And this is the, if the iron has the same density as the inner core, it would be over here, but the velocity is much higher than Prem. So there is also a discrepancy. And what the cause of the discrepancy could be because of the presence of light elements. It could also indicate maybe the core is not totally solid. Maybe there's some kind of liquid inside. Usually liquid would act to decrease the Vs, possibly. So there are these data suggesting that the inner core also contains lighter elements. So now, what do we know about the composition? What are the lighter elements? In 1952, Birch was proposing that the core is made of iron nickel plus one lighter elements. And that's Occam's razor principle. You just consider one principal lighter elements. And then about 30 years later, David Stevenson says, we have no reason to believe the core is so much cleaner than the mantle. We know in the crust, we have everything, right? In the mantle, we think, okay, in the upper mantle, we have olivine, pyroxene, garnet. In the lower mantle, we have perovskite, ferropericlase. And when it comes to the core, we say, okay, it's iron plus some lighter elements. So we see we are assuming that the crust contains everything. But as we go down deeper, everything gets cleaner. That's not because nature is really like that. Most likely it's because the core really is very simple, but because our knowledge of the core is very limited. We know so much about the crust, and then we see the complexity in the crust. And then Brad recognized that we have too few data, too many extrapolations. So we don't know much about the core. We only have very limited experimental data. We always extrapolate all the way from like 10 GPA to 300 GPA. And that extrapolation is very dangerous, as you have seen from yesterday's tutorial. When we try to extrapolate the density of iron sulfide, it becomes physically unrealistic. So we have this problem. This is recognized more than 20 years ago. Nowadays, we've got more data, but we still don't have enough data to really say things with confidence about the core. And there are review papers in the literature. In 1990, Zhang Lo has a review paper. 94, Poirier has a review paper. 2000, Hilgren was focusing on light elements. And in 2003 and 2007, myself and then Fei, we also have looked into all the existing data on the light element composition of the core and trying to see what people have learned over the years. And here is a illustration of the core composition. It's mainly made of iron, so that's good. The majority of the core is iron. It has a probably quadratic proportion of nickel. Then it has lighter elements. This proportion is uncertain. It can vary from a few percent all the way to 10%, depending on which lighter elements is there. For hydrogen, you may need a little bit. For silicon, which is not much lighter than iron, you might need a lot. So this proportion in weight percent is uncertain. And we also have all kinds of other elements in the core we know for sure. All the highly certified elements, they like to go with iron, so they will be mainly stored in the core. But these would be still trace elements. Altogether, they probably add up to less than 1%. And we talk about potassium, thorium, uranium. We don't know if they are in the core, but potentially they could be. Some of them could be hiding in the core. So in some way, the core is almost the magic box. People, you know, whenever something is missing, they say, okay, niobium is in the core, potassium is in the core, whatever is missing in the mantle, people usually put it into the core because we don't know. We'll never be able to find out. So we ask this question, what really are the lighter elements, or what really are the principal lighter elements? How do we find out about this? Now, how do you go about to kind of determine what is the most important the lighter element in the core? So first we start with to match the density and the velocities. And mineral physicists have spent a lot of efforts trying to measure the velocity and the density of all kinds of iron light element alloys. So the major candidates for the lighter elements includes hydrogen, which is the most abundant element in the solar system. The sun is mainly made of hydrogen. And the Earth might have some hydrogen. We have talk about the water in the Earth. So hydrogen is one of the candidate. Carbon is another element, very rich in carbonaceous chondrites, right? So if the Earth has some carbon, it could be storing in the core. Carbon is also very light. It goes easily with iron. And we have sulfur. That's one of my favorite candidate for the core light elements. It also easily alloy with iron. And the nickel, that's not a light element. It's actually heavier than iron, slightly heavier. And we have silicon. Now, silicon is very abundant in the Earth, the silicate part of the Earth. So if some of the silicon goes into the core, it could also lower the velocity, lower the density, and then change the velocity. Another very important element is oxygen, which is actually not listed here because we don't have data yet available for both velocity and density. Now, oxygen is the most abundant element in the Earth. So the core might contain some oxygen and to reduce density and change velocity. So these plot, Vp versus density, and here Vs versus density, we can see that these are different symbols for different lighter elements. Most of them, they do have the capability of reducing density, and then they would increase velocity. In this kind of plot, what we do is try to see whether the slope can match this. When you have the right conditions, whether it really matches both the location and the density dependence of velocity. And here what we show is the density in the core. And this is velocity in the core. And these are the different lighter elements when they extrapolate to this region, how do they match? So when you have, for instance, iron carbide, when the density matches the core, the velocity is actually too high over here. And then for Vs, none of them can reproduce the Vs of the inner core. But remember, again, most of the measurements are conducted at room temperature because high temperatures are not easy to reach. So as we go on, we are going to have more data and really have a more critical test which elements can match the inner core. And maybe it turns out none of them can really match. Then we have to go to more complicated model to say the core contains not only one principal element, maybe there are more than one that can balance out. So you would have a model that takes care of, you know, the proportion of different lighter elements. So this is one way to try to find out what light elements is in the core. But apparently, from this figure, probably, I hope you can conclude the same thing, that we actually do not know. It's possible, on the one hand, that none of them can really match. On the other hand, maybe many of them can match. If you really loosen the constraint to say, I can mix different light elements, then you can come up with non-unique solution. So this approach alone is not going to give us the answer.
It's quite possible that the S velocity in the inner core could increase with depth, because the S velocity that you get from PREM is based on normal modes, which sample the top of the inner core more than the center. And so that might also be something to consider at some point, although pinning down by how much that
would okay.
Since we have the properties increasing in the inner core, we know that BP increases, and we also know that BP at P attenuation definitely increases, decreases, that is, Q increases in the inner core. So it's
I didn't quite understand. VS does increase with depth, right?
Isn't the reason you've got all those purple triangles there? That
yes.
That's with depth.
That's right. Right, this PREM does show the VS increase with depth, but I think Barbara probably meant something else.
PREM has more or less, I mean, a larger increase.
Oh, okay, right. Okay, so you mean the magnitude of increase has to be more. Okay, so if it increases more, then it might, yeah.
The other thing that's true about those temperatures in the inner core is they're probably all within less than probably a few tenths of a percent of the melting temperature. Through the whole inner core.
So that's right.
You really want to do an experiment where you are getting the S velocity of solid iron at a temperature which is very, very close to its melting temperature.
Yeah, that's going to be challenging, but you do need that kind of a condition in order really to say whether there's this discrepancy is due to, yes, Abby?
Yeah, I have a similar question along those same lines. I mean, the inner core is at approximately probably very similar temperatures throughout. I mean, from a mineral physics point of view, like percentage of whatever temperature it is, and then approximately, you know, similar pressures. I mean, pressure and temperature don't change a whole lot across the inner core. So for there to be a strong gradient in shear velocity implies something very interesting probably about what's down there, the mineral physics. So if there's a strong change in shear velocities as you go through the inner core, that's probably not satisfied by just
PT
compression of a single material.
There may be a layer at the top of the inner core that's sort of mushy or whatever you call it.
Yes, later on I have a slide showing that more recent results about the top of the inner core boundary.
There's another recent suggestion that the shear velocity at high frequencies might be much higher. Kelvin and March Rand say there's some scattering that could account for much higher shear velocity on order of 4.
You mean within the range of seismic frequencies?
Right, within seismic frequencies, whereas the shear module is really the only measurement that's a pre-oscillation measurement that's very trustworthy.
Yes.
I have another question about adding light elements to iron. Mm. So my physical intuition works from a starting point where when you add any light element at high pressures and temperatures to iron, that it's basically ideal mixing. So, you know, when you add, you know, a certain concentration of a certain mass element, you just substitute in for the iron, and then you can do a linear combination of masses to get a new density. Now, is there anything in the data that suggests that you have any chemical effects, so that hydrogen or carbon behave very differently from silicon, for example, in that respect? I mean, can you just normalize to their
right, I see what you're saying, right, yeah.
And get the same result? Does it matter which light element is in there?
Yes, right, yeah, that's a very good question. I think in the beginning, many years ago, David Stevenson even proposed when you add hydrogen, instead of decreasing the density, you might increase the density. The reason is hydrogen is so small. If hydrogen is not substituting iron, but going into interstitial space, that means the total volume is fixed. You're just adding something in to increase the mass. And if you calculate density like mass over volume, it's going to increase density instead of decreasing, right? But turns out when we measure the iron hydride, this is iron hydrogen alloy, the density does decrease. That means when it goes in, it's not just sitting in the interstices. Maybe it goes into the interstitial side, but it still expands the ladders. So the change in volume still overcomes the change in mass, so the density goes down. I think the effect is the ideal mixing is not totally applicable. I haven't have included slides here, but in the paper we had reviewed this data, it suggests when you have different end members, like you have iron sulfide, and iron Fe3S, iron Fe2S, you do this mixing, they do not all line up in the same line. That implies that you cannot simply say this many percent of light elements, depending on its mass, is going to change the density by that much. I think it's more. It has, in other words, yes, there is a chemical effect, I think. The partial volume cannot be assumed to be an ideal mixing. The effect, how big is the effect, that's depending on which light elements. We don't have enough data to say for sure, but the very simple-minded ideal mixing model is not totally applicable when you try to figure out how many percent of light elements is in the core. So we want to look at other ways. It's almost like when you play a puzzle, you want to go this way and doesn't really fit everything, so you want to take a different approach. One approach is to try to match densities of both the outer core and the inner core. Instead of trying to match the density and the velocity, we can do that. So that is based on the understanding or the observation. When you have different system, for instance, I show the iron sulfur system on the left and iron silicon system on the right. And then when you have at one bar, if you have the core, outer core above the liquid curve over here, when the core cools, it's going to grow an inner core. And this inner core that comes out of the liquid, if the pressure is at one bar, it's going to be a pure iron. So you have liquid over here and a pure iron over here. When you increase pressure, the situation is going to be slightly different. So when you increase pressure, you start from above liquid as a total melt, and you cool the core and hit the liquid as you have the solid coming out. This solid, it turns out, the experiment shows that it contains some amount of sulfur, maybe on the form of 1%. It's not a lot. So in this case, if you have iron sulfur system, that means the outer core contains a lot of sulfur, the inner core contains very little sulfur. So you can, so maybe if this is the case, then sulfur alone cannot match the density deficit in both outer and the inner core, because it doesn't really go into the inner core to reduce the density. And you could have a very different situation with iron silicon. In this case, iron silicon has more or less almost a solid solution kind of behavior instead of the eutectic behavior. So when you start from a liquid and trying to solidify an inner core, this solid portion is going to contain a lot of silicon, not too different from the liquid. So if you have this kind of situation for the inner core growth, then the inner core and outer core will contain almost a similar amount of lighter elements. Then you would have to produce a similar amount of density deficit, which is not observed. So this system may not work either. And you can measure these at a higher pressure. Looks like for iron silicon system at about 21 GPa, it still looks more or less like, behaves like this over here. So the solid phase and the liquid phase has a similar amount of light elements, and that simply wouldn't work. There are some theoretical calculations to look at the situation for instance, silicon, sulfur silicon, they would say solid has 8.5% of these lighter elements, liquid has 10, very close to each other. And then they say, okay, these two elements do not work because they would produce too much density deficit in the inner core. And you have the other case with oxygen. The oxygen doesn't go into solid, it's almost none, no oxygen in the solid. But in the liquid, you have a lot of oxygen. So this is, situation is similar to the iron sulfide. So maybe this one works, because you do need more lighter elements in the outer core than in the inner core. So based on theoretical calculation, ab initio method, these authors conclude that oxygen would be a very good candidate.
That's at what temperatures?
When they do the calculation, I believe they did consider temperature effect.
Is it also true that those theoretical calculations are at much higher pressures?
They are, yes, because they can just...
And is that the reason for the difference?
There is actually, for sulfur, that would be the difference. But for silicon, this is similar to the experimental data at the low pressure, right? For oxygen, there is no experimental data to suggest how, at this condition, what would be the partitioning between solid and liquid.
Do we know where the, what pressures that this change for sulfur happens? Because that's where
It's actually
the smaller, pressures in the interior.
Yeah, it's probably gradually, because up to 20, below 25 GPa, you have basically a clean solid containing no sulfur coming out. At 25, you do have about 1%. Recent data at 40 GPa shows that this concentration increased more. So looks like this is a gradual effect. Not really you have an abrupt pressure where all of a sudden it increases a lot. At least so far, we don't have any data suggesting that. So this is another approach, trying to match density of both outer and inner core. And this can give you more critical test, which one can work, if you assume a binary system containing iron and one lighter elements. But again, this one doesn't give you a sure answer. There's possibly like more than one solution to this.
So what are the challenges to bring these kind of experiments to higher pressure?
Higher pressure, yes. So these kind of experiments basically is you need to have a partially molten system at this high pressure and high temperature. So I think the key is to, whenever you try to melt something in a diamond anvil cell, the experiments become very challenging. Plus, you have to measure the property of two phases instead of one. So this is much more difficult than doing, let's say, equation of state, because you're focusing on one solid phase normally. And often, you need to analyze the chemical composition. That means you have to recover the sample, and the sample is very small. When you open the diamond anvil cell, you may lose the sample right away without being able to capture it and analyze it. I think it's just a matter of experimental challenge of reaching these conditions and partially melt the sample and then being able to recover it afterwards. So there are several steps you need to do.
And those are important, and there's one more, in that in order to do equilibrium geochemistry, the sample needs to be at thermal equilibrium, so the temperature basically has to be constant throughout. And in the laser-heated diamond anvil cell, there are very strong temperature gradients where you have 3,000 degrees, and 10 microns away you have 1,000 degrees. And so it's just not under that equilibrium condition that's required to do a real partitioning experiment.
Yeah, that's a good point. Both the temperature gradient and the temperature stability would be issue, how it varies with time and how it varies with space. But I think we will get more data as time goes on. As somebody was trying to say, yes,
Victor. About the theoretical calculation?
Yes.
Is there some reason we can't take these as truth?
Yes.
yes, I think there is a very good reason we don't take, at least I don't take it as true, because they have done theoretical calculation, they have very good guidance, right? It works with experiments well. But they have made lots of claims in the past which turn out to be wrong, right?
Why is that?
Because I think the theories are very good at the predicting trends, like dependence, pressure dependence, temperature dependence, but their calibration, for instance, the pressure can be easily off by hundreds of GPa. They don't have very good calibration of where pressure is. Plus, they have all these energetic terms. If they just ignored one term, they have different approximation, like GGA, LDA, and they don't really come to the same conclusion, right? But even within theory, they have disagreements.
Iron is particularly difficult.
Because of the correlated electron system mechanism in iron, right? Yes, Abby.
Let me amplify that. Theory is perfect for hydrogen. And the further away that you get from hydrogen, the more approximations that you have to make. And so, and again, as Barbara said, iron has particular difficulties because it's one of the transition metals that theory tries to deal with. And so when the d orbital population starts getting filled with electrons, things become a lot more complicated. So it's actually easier with things like oxygen and magnesium and silicon, but iron is more complicated.
So next week we'll have Renata Renskovic. She can elaborate on this.
it's worth pointing out that these theoretical calculations actually do represent a major advance.
Yes, no doubt about it, right.
I mean, I've been waiting 30 years for it, so good enough for me. But and I think the major advance is density functional theory comes in, doesn't it? Which is discovered by the person in this building, this thing. That's probably going to be
Nobel Prize. Oh, okay. Yeah, they are making really great discoveries, but I think before the experiments kind of at least, before they converge to the same results and experiments confirm some of them, we still just, we cannot take them as the truth yet. Yes?
Let me shift the topic a little bit away from Earth. Like for the Mars core, it's a solid and it has a lower pressure. Does that program tell us there may be less sulfur in the core?
Well, in fact, the Martian core right now, people believe it's totally molten. I have a slide later on to show Martian core. Maybe we can come back to that when we get there. So this is another approach, but again, like we do not have we do not have definite answers from this thing. So another approach is from geochemistry and cosmochemistry. We do mass balance. That's a pretty simple concept. So if you know the Earth, the bulk Earth, you can look at the chondrites and have an idea of what the bulk Earth is made of. And then you can study the mantle based on xenoliths and all these magmas, and you can have an idea of what the mantle is made of. And then you can see whatever is missing from the mantle, they should be in the core. That's the basic idea. And we can confirm this. For instance, I think Stan and Cinti mentioned that for refractory lithophile elements, we have a pretty good constraints for what the bulk Earth has. And some of the refractory, so we have refractory elements, this is a lithophile elements, they are found in the mantle, but some xerophile elements, they are also refractory. That means they have very high condensation temperature. They do not get lost easily from the accreting material. So if you look at these xerophile elements, for instance, iron, cobalt, nickel, these are the major components. Iron is major components of the core. And then you have highly xerophile elements. These elements, they like iron a lot. So whenever iron is present, they basically all go into the iron. They do not like to stay with silicates. And you see that these elements, they are really missing. So this is the abundance in the silicate earth, includes the crust and the mantle. Normalized to C1 chondrites. And in the mantle, the highly xerophile elements are depleted by almost a factor of 1,000. And that can be easily explained by their incorporation in the iron-rich core. And you can do the same with other elements, let's say silicon. You know, how much silicon is in the mantle? How much silicon is in the starting bulk earth, the total inventory? And you can look at the sulfur. For instance, sulfur is over here. This trend is so-called volatility trend. That means we think this trend represents how much volatile elements are present in the bulk earth. And then these are the mantle composition. Okay, sulfur is depleted by about a factor of 100. That means sulfur has gone into the core. So we can play this game, very simple concept. And so according to this one, all the things that are plotted below these bounds, this flat line over here and the volatility trend over there, these would be all in the Earth's core. And that tells us what the composition of the Earth's core is. Unfortunately, you do not see oxygen on this plot because oxygen is such a special element. It's hard to really define the condensation temperature of oxygen because it does form oxides or maybe silicates. So the condensation temperature is not easy to define. Carbon is also missing from the plot. Carbon will probably plot way over here with very low condensation temperature. We simply have uncertainties in what other bulk inventory, the total budget of these elements in the bulk in the Earth. If we do know, and if we assume that lower mantle and upper mantle are the same composition, then we can infer the core composition. So this is a very useful exercise. This might be the basis of how we figure out what's in the core. You know, iron is missing from the mantle. The mantle contains much less iron than chondritic materials. Therefore, we think iron is in the core, and sulfur for the same reason. So it's very helpful, but doesn't solve our problem because of the complication. Yes?
I think you have to be a little careful. This is okay. A volatility trend.
Yes.
What it means, that whole collection of elements isn't necessarily in the core. This collection of elements also can be deficient because they were never condensed.
Right. Yes. I meant if they plot below the volatility trend, then they might be in the core.
That's well, the volatility right. trend is very poorly defined.
Exactly. So. That's right. That's right. So, right. That's the complication. If this is well defined, then we actually have very easy life. We just say whatever is missing, they would be either in the lower mantle or in the core. Right. The lower mantle is another complication. this volatility trend is poorly defined. That's
Jack,
why.
I have a question about that too. I mean, this volatility, is it based on the condensation of the elements, or is it based on condensation of the compounds that contain those elements?
It's based on condensation. It's actually neither. So what you do is you have you start with a starting like a composition similar to what you the nebular solar nebular composition. You cool it and you measure each individual element, how much is in the gas phase, how much is in the condensates. So they could be in different phases. So it could be in multiple phases. You just measure the element abundance. And what Stan said about the complications, there is definitely complications in like volatile depletion. Even within different classes of chondritic materials, we have large variation. So this is a plot showing different kinds of chondrites, CV, CO, CM, and refractory, moderately volatile and highly volatile. You see there's a large variation even among chondritic material. And for Earth, there is even larger uncertainty. And these uncertainty, it's also related to the theory of how planets form, how the Earth form. Because in the past, we have this very simplistic idea that sun is in the center. As you go away from the sun, you have more and more volatiles. So when you're close to the sun, the volatiles at high temperature, they're blown away. So you have more depleted, volatile depleted planets in, close to the sun, and volatile enriched planets away from the sun. For instance, we believe Mars. Martian core contains much more sulfur than the Earth's core because Mars is further away from the sun. But recently, there are many studies showing these kind of a simple idea doesn't really work. The condensation, you know, is, according to heliocentric distance, doesn't really work. The reason is you have a lot of radio mixing during the formation of the planets. So the materials get mixed at a different distance. And even at a later stage, there are things like planet migration, planet formed. Planetesimals formed farther away from the sun migrate into a closer orbital and then accrete to the Earth. For instance, the giant impact theory of the Earth, you have a Mars-sized object impact the Earth. Now, what's the origin of the Mars-sized object? Maybe it formed further away, contained a lot of volatiles. And what are the fate of the volatiles during the giant impact and the reassembling of the Earth? And we also have late heavy bombardments which supply elements to the Earth. So there are all these complications make the mass balance approach, again, not sufficient to tell us what went into the core. So nothing works perfectly. And we look in another direction. We look at solubility of elements in the core because we want to see, you know, if you have these elements present in the Earth, do they go into the core or not? So you look at solubility. And then in this case, you have to consider the accretion model. So how did the Earth form? And there are generally two large categories. One says heterogeneous accretion. That means the core forms first and the mantle forms later in a simple term. So how does that work? Usually people would say in the beginning, the oxygen-free gas is very low. The whole environment is reduced. This is reasonable if you consider the sun is totally made of hydrogen. Maybe in the beginning, there are a lot of hydrogen present. The total environment is reduced. So you have iron present as metal. They just directly accrete to the core. And then later on, as hydrogen gets blown away, the environment gets more oxidizing. So you would have iron combined with oxygen to form iron oxide, and the silicon would also combine with oxygen to form silica. So then you have the silicate mantle forming later on. So this is one large category. The other category says these kind of materials, they are present all over the place. They just really very fastly accrete into the Earth. They didn't have time to sort out. But later on, through some process, they would have a segregation, core mantle segregation, then it would have to form a core like this. This one is considered a homogeneous accretion because the material in the beginning is a mixture of material and having more or less uniform kind of a distribution of metal and the silicates. So you have these two categories. They have different implications for what goes into the core. In this scenario, you have reducing condition in the beginning. In this case, silicon, for instance, usually silicon would form silica if oxygen is around. But if it's very reduced, silicon might go into the core. And oxygen wouldn't go into the core in this scenario. But in the other scenario, then it depends on the condition of the core formation. then depending on under these kind of PT condition and oxygen-free gas condition, what kind of elements would dissolve into iron? So this is another line people are trying to look at what goes into the core. And then a popular hypothesis recently, in the last 10 years or so, is the deep magma ocean scenario. That hypothesized that the core formation during at some stage of the Earth's core may be initiated by core formation process. There is a very deep layer of melt on the surface of the Earth. The depth of the magma ocean could be hundreds of kilometers to even more than 1,000 kilometers. So in this magma ocean, you have the iron droplets, melts, and you have the molten silicates. Because of the density difference, the droplets would rain down, and then they meet the solid mantle underneath. At the solid boundary, they would pond over here. And during this ponding stage, they would have time to interact with the overlying silicates. So the chemical equilibrium between the core material and the mantle would be would happen at this kind of pressure and temperature condition. So this is relatively high pressure and high temperature. And then you can look at under these pressure temperature conditions, what are the solubility of different light elements in the metal? For instance, there are several studies. You know, I have a study with my advisor. We found that sulfur gets even more siderophile. They like iron even more as you increase pressure and the temperature. So we think that sulfur can totally be depleted from the mantle. They all go into the core. And then later on, there is a study by Gassman et al. They found that the silicon, as you increase pressure and temperature, silicon actually also become more soluble in iron. So they propose silicon would be in the core. And in 06, there's a study by Ruby et al. Showing over here. This is a look at oxygen solubility in iron nickel liquid as a function of temperature, different temperature over here. So this is the high temperature and the pressure. So what they found is high temperature really favors oxygen going into the iron nickel alloy. And then they said, okay, oxygen into the core. So people trying to look at the pressure temperature effect on solubility or affinity of light elements with iron nickel alloy, then they reached different conclusions. But in general, they found light elements being more soluble at high pressure and high temperature. This is also used as the basis to explain why the Earth's mantle has much more iron than Martian mantle. They would say Mars is much smaller, so that if Mars also had a magma ocean, the magma ocean is shallower at a lower pressure and temperature. Especially the effective temperature is very large. So if you are at lower temperature, like here, then you would have a much smaller amount of oxygen going into the core. And if you have a higher temperature, then you have a lot more oxygen going into the core. So this is another category, yes?
So in this figure where the iron raining down is sort of ponding in localized kind of areas along the liquid solid part of the silicate,
yes.
Is there a reason why we would expect that not just sort of a homogeneous ring of stuff?
Oh, you mean here why they are just...
The cartoon or...
That's a cartoon, okay. Yeah. In other cartoons, you'll see them just having a homogeneous layer.
There's no meaning to that.
No, I don't think there is a meaning on that, yeah.
I think in some of Dave's more recent stuff, Dave Ruby's more recent stuff, I think he's finding that some of the solubilities go back up again with increasing pressure. Sort of recent.
With pressure,
yeah, no,
you mean?
That's absolutely right. I mean, what you got there is absolutely right. But I think in some later papers, I think he was finding that the solubilities of things like oxygen was going up.
Going up with pressure.
So the volume which determines this.
Right. Yes, I remember that paper. They were also trying to put on a constraint on the partial volume of oxygen, like compressibility of oxygen. That's right. And then, you know, as we say, we understand the core formation, but we almost assume, like what Stan said, 30 million years ago, it takes only about 30 million years for core formation to finish. But in fact, there are more recent studies suggesting core formation may be an ongoing process. The core mantle boundary is not a fixed boundary. It might change with time. For instance, one set of studies showing that the role of perovskite in core formation. There is a study suggesting the lower mantle might have might contain some small amount of iron metal, even nowadays. And the reason is when you have perovskite, you start with, let's say, olivine or andesite, which has iron in the 2+ form, the ferrous iron. But when it transforms into perovskite, with the presence of aluminum, it could have a decomposition reaction to form a iron 3+ bearing perovskite and iron metal. They have shown some experimental evidence suggesting this. So this could play an important role in core formation in early time. It could still be going on nowadays. That means you have, when this andesite or olivine come into the lower mantle, they might shed iron. And this iron could be partially retained in the lower mantle, but in the early time, they could come out and then go into the core. With this kind of process, you know, we have to ask, what does it imply about light elements? In this process, what kind of light elements can be incorporated into this iron before it drains down into the core? So this is one of the things, very recent hypothesis, and people haven't had the time to explore fully the implication of this for the composition of the core yet. Another new discovery, which is a surprise, is at the core mantle boundary, at a very high pressure temperature, the interaction between metal and solid, metal and the silicates is not what we expected at a low pressure and low temperature. Usually, in the past, the people think if you have oxygen in the core, then you don't have silicon in the core. They are mutually exclusive. The reason is oxygen goes into iron, combines with iron under oxidizing condition, and silicon works under reducing condition. They are mutually exclusive. But the recent study shows that you could incorporate both elements together as a iron FeSiO3 component. They go into the core together. So that's a really a surprise. That means you could actually have silicon and oxygen both into the both existing in the Earth's core. So it just makes the issue more complicated, and also suggests that maybe you cannot assume a binary system with containing iron and just one lighter element. It could be more present. So now we have talked about, you know, how to find out what the light elements are, and the conclusion is we do not really know yet. We have very a list of candidates. These are the major candidates, but we still don't know for sure. We need more data. And now we think about what do the light elements do when they are in the core. The one thing is they're going to affect the melting temperature. So this is a 1-bar iron sulfur system illustrating the eutectic melting relation. So this is the melting temperature of iron at ambient condition and the melting temperature of iron sulfide, troilite here. But when the two phases are together, the melting temperature, the first melt appears at a much lower temperature than both end members, and this is known as the eutectic melting behavior. And if you have certain amount of sulfur, let's say we have 10%, you start from here. If there's no sulfur, the melting temperature would be slightly above 1800. When you add sulfur to it, the melting temperature is reduced by more than 100 degrees. So one of the effects of light elements is going to reduce the melting temperature. That means if you have sulfur in the core, the inner core boundary temperature would be sitting over here, depending on the sulfur content, instead of at the melting temperature of iron. So we would have to consider the effect of light elements when we estimated the temperature at the inner core boundary. So here we have a summary of how different lighter elements would affect the melting temperature of iron. And this is a case for sulfur. And the first impression is a lot of data, a lot of scatter. Right? So this curve, the gray curve over here, is for pure iron. And then you have different measurements for iron sulfur compounds and alloys. And then we have also the eutectic melting temperature. This is a eutectic. So eutectic temperature is much lower than the melting temperature of a pure iron. And it actually changes in a way that's not expected. It goes down with pressure in the beginning, and it goes up again. And then these are different. At high pressure normally, like Williams and Zhanglo, Bowler, these are studies from laser-heated diamond anvil cell. They have quite large uncertainties. Especially early studies, the temperature may have been overestimated. And so if you use this diagram to estimate core temperature, you can easily get more than 1,000 degrees uncertainty. And also, you see this red symbols over here. These are more recent studies published in 07. There's three different studies, all of them carried out in, this is a large volume study. These two are diamond anvil cell studies. Again, you see that we are not really converging to a very narrow line, even though new studies have been carried out. So the general impression is you do have, when you add sulfur, the melting temperature is going to go down. Only a couple of curves showing the end member actually crossing the melting temperature of iron. So iron sulfide melts at a lower temperature at 1 bar, but as pressure increase, they might actually cross. And this is also the case with oxygen system. And for FeO, this kind of behavior might be interesting for understanding the ultra-low velocity zone when you have the FeO component. So that's the next slide showing the oxygen effect on the melting temperature. So here we have the compound FeO, and then the other FeO. FeO is not a stoichiometric, so you have not a one-to-one ratio, but you have a deficiency of iron here. So people measure the melting temperature of the FeO. Again, at the low temperature, FeO melts at low pressure, that melts at a low temperature. But as pressure increases, it actually crosses the melting temperature of iron, at least in some studies. And here is the melting temperature of the FeO binary system. And this binary system, they plot below the pure iron. That tells us that when you add oxygen, the melting temperature is also going to go down. And then this is the eutectic system of the ternary system containing both oxygen and sulfur. So the melting temperature would go down even further. So in general, adding light elements is going to lower the melting temperature of iron and give us a lower estimate of temperature at the core mantle boundary. And not a core mantle, but the inner core boundary. So another important thing the light elements do is we believe that the light elements play an important role in sustaining the geodynamo. And I'm sure Bruce will give a much more detailed and then more enlightening discussion on this part. So here it's just simply illustrating. You have a dynamo theory, which tells us how much energy do you need to drive the dynamo. I'm not sure if these numbers are really correct, but this is a very large, very rough number. So dynamo theory can give us estimate of the amount of energy needed to drive the dynamo. And then you can look at the energy source that are available for the dynamo to run. There is an energy source of primordial heating. That means the Earth was very hot because of the formation process, accreting process. As time go on, it's going to lose heat. So some of the heat will be available to drive the dynamo. We may also have radiogenic heat. That's due to the presence of radioactive elements. As they decay, they give out heat. Another thing is because of the crystallization to form the inner core, that gives out the latent heat. And that latent heat can also supply some energy to drive thermal convection. So thermal convection is due to the temperature difference because there's too much heat stored over here and not we need convection to get rid of this heat. And you can calculate this kind of this energy based on Fourier's law at the core mantle boundary. You can look at the temperature difference, delta T, at the core mantle boundary. Look at it over a certain thickness of the core mantle boundary, and then you have estimate of the thermal conductivity of materials at the core mantle boundary. You have the area, that's the area of the core mantle boundary at the core mantle boundary depth. And with this equation, you can estimate how much heat is going out at the core mantle boundary. Turns out this heat is estimated at 6 to 12 kilowatts. I think this is a very rough number. The number itself has large uncertainty. But what you can tell is this number is smaller than what is needed. So the discrepancy between the thermal convection and the energy needed to run dynamo is believed to be provided by chemical convection due to the release of light elements at the inner core boundary when the inner core forms. So for the Earth, we know that if we have light elements in the outer core, when you form the inner core doesn't take as much light elements in most cases. So you would have a concentration of light elements at the inner core boundary as the core crystallizes. And these light elements, because they are lighter than the core above them, so they try to rise up. And that will drive drive the dynamo. So this is the case for the Earth. And we would go beyond the Earth to think about if this is the, is this the case for all the dynamo in the solar system. We have different planets in the solar system, and many of them have a dense metallic core. For instance, Earth has the picture of the Earth is shown over here, and Mercury over here. We have the Mercury has a very large core, and we don't know if Mercury has an inner core. And here is the illustration of different core, amount of core inside of a planet. We have the Moon might have a very small core. The Earth has a core with 16% of volume. Venus has a core which is about 12%. Mars has a slightly smaller core. Mercury has a very large core, almost half of the planet's volume. And even beside the terrestrial planets, we also have terrestrial-like satellites. For instance, the satellites of Jupiter, they have also dense metallic cores. So the cores exist not only in the Earth, so we want to compare to see if the chemical convection is also operating in other planets. And then, because we believe the chemical convection is important for the magnetic field, we want to see what other planetary bodies also have a magnetic field. And in the solar system, we have this 8 planets, 4 giant planets, 4 terrestrial-like planets. All the giant planets, they have magnetic fields. I think that's one of the important subject of the dynamo workshop happening just which ended yesterday. But these are very different schemes. So we focus on terrestrial planets. Among the 4 terrestrial planets, we only have 2 of them with a magnetic field, with a global detected global magnetic field. The Earth has a field which is about half Gauss in intensity. And this half Gauss is about maybe a few percent of a fridge magnet. If you have a kitchen magnet, it has an intensity of maybe 20 to 50 Gauss. The Earth has a field of half Gauss. And if you look at the Mercury, Mercury has a global magnetic field which is much weaker than the Earth. It's less than a hundredth of the intensity of the Earth. And the other 2 planets, which we believe they're very similar to the Earth, turns out they do not have a magnetic field, at least not presently. Mars doesn't have it, Venus doesn't have it. And if you look at the terrestrial-like bodies, Jupiter's moons, then Ganymede is the one which shows a detectable global field. The field is even stronger than Mercury's field, but it's much weaker than the Earth's field. So we ask the question, if chemical convection is important for driving the Earth's dynamo, is it also happening in these planets? Do they also have an inner core? Right? We know they have a core, but we do not know if they have inner core. And then has these kind of light elements released at the inner core boundary?
I have a question.
Yes.
Did they take samples on these Mars missions for paleomagnetic stuff? So to find out whether there was a magnetic field or
I
not?
Think Catherine, in her talk, did mention that they have indications for paleomagnetism on Mars.
They measure from satellites. So
right.
You see the random crustal field and the rocks actually affecting magnetic field of the satellite, right? So it's quite strong, surprisingly strong, actually.
Using the distribution of impact bases that are magnetized or not magnetized, constrain the shutdown of the fields quite precisely to about 3.9 billion years.
3.9 billion years.
The crater counting is a precise plot.
Yes.
So again, we remember that for the Earth's formation of the Earth's core, it happens like this. We have adiabat, we have a liquidus, a temperature. They cross at the high pressure end, so we have the inner core growing in the center. So we can calculate, we can measure the liquidus by experiments to see at each pressure, what temperature does the material melt. We can also calculate the adiabat, depending on the also material properties, the thermal expansion, density, heat capacity. And then you would have different foot temperature. As the Earth cools, the adiabats would move down along the temperature. So that's the case for the Earth. Turns out for Ganymede, people found that the situation might be very different. And there are many possible ways the inner core can form. So there is a possibility that Ganymede has a totally a molten core. There's also a possibility that it has a core like the Earth, have a solid iron inner core, liquid core which contains lighter elements. And then they have other cases. They found that maybe solid iron is going to crystallize at the top of the core and snow down to join the inner core like this. So this is a case of a snowing core. And then in the snowing core case, you might already have a solid inner core in the center, or you might be not forming anything yet. It's just snowing and it hasn't had a chance to form a solid inner core. And then there's another possibility that you have multiple precipitation points. That means you form solid iron at the top. It snows down. And you can form solid iron sulfide at the high pressure. And this thing, because it's lower density, it might rise up like that. And there are other complications. You only have this rising solid iron sulfur. And you could have a situation that this thing starts in the middle of the core, or it starts at the bottom of the core. And then it could be that this has evolved to the extent it already formed a layer at the top of the core, below the core mantle boundary. So you have so many possibilities, according to these people, to form inner core. It's not that you always form inner core like the Earth with the inner core growing in the center. What, under what situation would you have a snowing core? So that would be the case if you have the liquidus, which has a shallower slope than the adiabat, or it could even be negative slope. That means the liquid temperature is going down as you increase pressure. In this case, as your adiabat starts from here, as you cool down, you would intersect the liquidus at the low pressure end, near the core mantle boundary. So the solidification of iron will occur at the shallow depths. And then because this iron is denser than the surrounding liquid, it's going to snow down. Finally, it accumulates to form a solid inner core. And over here, because the iron is snowing down, change the composition over here. So it becomes much more iron rich. And then the liquidus is going to turn into more like the liquidus of iron. And then this is the point where you would form the inner core. So this is a scenario. You have a snowing core forming solid iron near the core mantle boundary and raining down to form the inner core. So this is one of the possibilities. So now we look at the Martian core. As I mentioned earlier, more recent data suggests that the Martian core is totally molten. I don't know. I think in the past, people have kind of talked about different possibilities. Maybe it's totally solid. Maybe it's like partially molten. But right now, we are pretty sure that it's totally molten at the present time. But as the core cools, then there are two pathways for the core to evolve. One is you could have a snowing core. So the core has solid iron forming at the core mantle boundary, and it snows down to form a inner core. And the other situation, if the core contains more sulfur, then you might have a sulfide core. You might have a iron nickel sulfide forming as the inner core. And this phase is lighter than the surrounding solid because it contains more sulfur. So this one is going to try and rise. And then as things going on, it's going to evolve like this. And then you end up with this kind of configuration for the core. In the end, this one has a iron sulfide as the inner core. This one has iron nickel in the inner core, depending on the sulfur content. And here it illustrates how the adiabat changes with different sulfur content. When you have 10% of sulfur, you have these kind of liquidus curve. The gradient has a negative slope. When you have 14.2%, it also has a negative slope. But if the sulfur content is higher, then the liquidus slope is positive.
Are these eutectic temperatures?
These are not eutectic. These are liquidus temperature.
Okay.
Yeah. If it's eutectic, you only have one, right?
Yep.
I have a question.
Yes.
Is it possible to have a third possibility instead of snowing, and that the light material solidifies at the top, just stays there instead of snowing down?
Oh, that's a possibility, but it's not indicated by the phase diagram. So if you check, giving a certain sulfur content, you want to see what is the first phase that crystallized out. solidifies out. If you have a lot of sulfur, it's possible that you actually form, you would have the solid phase coming out as the sulfide phase. I think, let's see which one would show, okay. Yeah, if you, let's say your composition is over here, then when you crystallize, you would have this phase coming out. So you would have the situation, you have enough sulfur, plus the liquidus curve has to be negative. So when you, these two conditions are met, you might have the scenario what you have imagined. Yes?
I thought the viscosity of the liquid iron is pretty low, so is it possible that you might be able to just keep the snowing iron sort of floating through turbulence or something so that it all just kind of, it's sort of a uniform,
okay,
partially molten situation without any.
Oh, like slurry.
Like a slurry, kind of thing. But that you can entrain the stuff instead of letting it snow down to the snow.
Yeah, the details of this, like and how this iron snow segregates, whether it dissolves again right away, whether it really plunged down like hail kind of to the bottom, or it gets entrained through the turbulence, the convection in the outer core, we really don't know. Because people, this would require people like Bruce and other dynamo people to look into, you know, what happens. Now, when you have low viscosity, I thought that means that you could easily, very quickly segregate things, right?
It would depend on the density difference, but if this stuff was sort of sustained or suspended at all, wouldn't it just melt away?
It depends on the grain size, right? If the grain size, if the crystallization has a lot of a nucleation point, lots of small things like a really little snow, then it might dissolve as it falls down. Mm-hmm. But if it's crystallized really fast, it might just sink right away. So there are really many possibilities how these things could evolve.
The really simple thing you can do is just calculate the terminal velocity of a particle of a certain size, and if it's too big, it just all shoots straight to the bottom. I think that you probably have to remain very skinny for them to take enough time before it all just falls out.
Right.
I don't have a feel for how small they are.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to calculate.
We don't know, yeah, I think that's.
It could be small enough for ground in motion to just keep them there. I think it's what you mean by a suspension.
But I mean, even things like in the atmosphere example, turbulence will keep ice crystals where they would fall out if it's sort of stagnant air, for example. So yes, it's certainly its Stokes velocities are versatile.
Yes, Abby.
Yeah, I might be jumping the gun here, but that sounds like it might be the nucleus of a good student project for the following week, is to kind of plot out the density space where you can have things that fall, where you can have particles that remain neutrally buoyant.
The density size issue. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
And the viscosity would also play a role, how fast the convection is,
yes.
Right. Yeah, and this is the situation for mercury. We were plotting the liquidus temperature inside of mercury's core. This is a common boundary of mercury, and that's the center of mercury. And depending on the sulfur content, again, we have uncertainty in how much sulfur is in mercury's core. If you consider mercury so close to the sun, maybe you think it doesn't have much sulfur. But the fact that mercury, the core, is molten, as indicated by recent satellite observation, tells us that it has to contain some lighter elements to keep it molten. Because it cannot be just the total iron, it will be frozen by now with such a small planet losing heat really fast. So turns out we don't know the sulfur content, so for a whole range of possible sulfur content from no sulfur to 12% sulfur, which is almost the limit according to other constraints, the geochemistry and the thermal evolution model. So we have these kind of liquidus curve. And we could also calculate the adiabat of mercury. And these are the two different possibilities with different foot temperature. So these would be the range of temperature inside mercury based on thermal evolution models. And then you can see that inside mercury's core, you have this negative slope at a relatively shallow depth at the Coleman boundary. The slope becomes positive within this region. And depending on the sulfur content, if you have high sulfur content, if you look at extreme condition, here is a negative gradient. And here you have another negative liquidus gradient. if you have this kind of situation, then it's possible you're crossing the liquidus, the adiabat is crossing the liquidus at two depths. One is near the core mantle boundary, the other is in the middle of the core. And you would have the situation, you have a double snow falling. So one snow forms right below the core mantle boundary, the other initiates in the middle of the core. In both places, you have a solid iron. It may contain a little bit of sulfur, but not much. They would form crystallize at this depth, and then they would try to fall down because of density difference. And then when you have a solid iron forming, you also simultaneously have a residual liquid which is rich in sulfur. This is the same situation at the inner core boundary of the Earth. You know, both of these boundaries would resemble the inner core boundary of the Earth. So in this region, you have a very sulfur-rich liquid which is lighter than the liquid above it, so it's going to try to rise. So in this case, you would have kind of a double diffusion scenario. The heat is trying to get out of the planet, and then sulfur-rich liquid is also trying to get out of the planet. They move upwards, but the solid iron would try to fall down and move inwards. So you have this motion of diffusion in both directions. And what are the implications for the Mercury's core? We don't know. Right now, people are having difficulties accounting for the intensity of the Mercury's magnetic field. So maybe there are different core dynamics we're not aware of that might account for the fact that such a small planet has a magnetic field, but it's a very weak magnetic field. To explain this, this might be a possible scenario. Yes?
So what is the physical explanation for why the slope goes negative?
Why the slope goes negative? There are several reasons the slope might go negative. One reason is the eutectic point is going to shift with pressure. And if you have the eutectic temperature changing, eutectic composition and the temperature changing as a function of pressure, and ends up you would have the melting temperature for a constant composition going down with pressure. That's the case for Mars. In the case of Mercury, it turns out at about 14 GPa, we found the Mercury's liquidus curve becomes very non-ideal. And that non-ideality gives us, so I can show you, since you asked that question, I think it might be good to show you the phase diagram there. There's something funny there? Okay, so this one would show the phase diagram. You see at the one bar, you have these kind of phase diagram, highly non-ideal with this kind of curvature. And 3 GPa, it becomes more ideal. And 10 GPa is nearly kind of matches ideal behavior. But at 14 GPa, then the liquidus curves like this. That means for the same composition, at 10 GPa, you have melting temperature over here. But at 14, the melting temperature might be much lower. So that gives you the negative liquidus slope. And for higher pressure, the situation is because the eutectic point at 23 GPa, the eutectic point is over here, if you look at the blue curve for iron. And then as pressure increases, it moves to a more iron-rich position and it moves to a higher temperature. So again, if you look at the same composition, you might end up with a different, maybe it's over for a very high sulfur content, that's very significant. For 10%, for instance, over here, you have the melting temperature nearly 2200, but 10% over here, the melting temperature is over here, maybe about 2000. So that means pressure increases, liquidus temperature decreases. So there are different reasons for that negative slope.
So,
yes.
Does that require negative ion solid when that happens?
It doesn't. It doesn't imply. It's only the melting temperature. It doesn't imply anything about the density. I don't think it has a direct implication for the density.
Have you tracked the density though? How it changes? Density
of
the melt,
density of the molar volume. Oh, density of the melt, okay.
Yeah.
No, I haven't tried. That may be something to look into.
Yeah, now you deal with a negative Teflon slope, you have the actual liquid becomes magnetic solids, so these solids float up.
Right, that's true for a one component system.
Yeah.
But as soon as you
right,
start
right.
the multi-components, then you have to worry about right. pressure molecules.
But that's something worth looking into, because these phase diagram tells something about the mixing relation between two different end members. Yeah, so I just want to briefly mention other mysteries about the core. One is there might be more boundaries in the outer core. For instance, there was a study using P4KP trying to detect any stratification in the outer core. Their result is negative. They say there's no stratification in the outer core. But more recently, there was a paper in press suggesting at the top of the outer core, there might be features, heterogeneity, on the order of maybe some of them tens of kilometers, others maybe 1,000 kilometers heterogeneity at the outer core. So there might be lateral variations. They may not be considered global boundary, but they could be heterogeneity in the liquid part of the core.
Actually, and I think there may be some evidence also for, sort of a more...
I'm going to show that in the next slide, right? This is there might be more boundary in the outer core, and that could be due to immiscibility in the liquid. This is experimental charge showing how two different liquids with different sulfur content, they can be immiscible, like oil and water. And then this is the phase diagram, FEOS system. Within certain composition, you might have two liquids coexisting, but with other composition, you have one liquid. So detecting these kind of boundary may be able to tell us, put some constraints on what is the composition that can allow that are allowed to have a uniform outer core, and in what region can you have a segregation of two liquids. And then there are features at the inner core boundary. This is probably what Barbara had in mind.
I meant at the outer, at the CMB.
Oh, you're talking about CMB, okay.
Below
yeah.
the CMB, evidence for...
Above the CMB, okay.
No, below the CMB.
Below the CMB.
The outer core, from this kind of waves that sample.
Right.
Actually, SKS.
Okay.
SNKS.
So they do show heterogeneity, right?
Not heterogeneity, but possibly some different gradients.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think Adam also mentioned something, right, the top of the outer core, right? And this would be at the bottom of the outer core. So there are some recent data by Barbara's group showing there may be bumps at the inner core boundary. And a few years ago, there was another study showing the inner core surface might have a mosaic structure with different velocity kind of features. So these are the things that requires explanation, how the crystallization process, the inner core growing process might be able to produce these kind of features. And then there might be more boundaries in the inner core. There is a study by Miyake and Adam showing there is an innermost inner core, this tiny region over here, which has a different isotropic kind of a structure from the rest of the inner core. And then more recently, there was additional data confirming the existence of the innermost inner core. So this would be the whole inner core. And there is an innermost inner core which is more isotropic, more or less isotropic than the rest of the inner core. So maybe the inner core itself is not just one layer, but more than, there are more either crystallographic orientation, like a crystal structure difference or compositional difference in the inner core. So these are the issues that the seismic observation have brought to us more recently, and we haven't had the chance to apply experimental geochemistry and mineral physics data to see what really it means about the what's going on inside the core. And that's the last slide I have. Thank you. Any more questions? Yes, Amy.
Some evidence or some experiments where they added hydrogen, and then a different study where they added oxygen. Has anyone looked at water in the core?
Yes. Water in the core, in a sense, they put iron together with water, and they see the formation of hydride. Mm-hmm. So there were a couple of studies, mainly by Japanese scientists. They see that the hydrogen can reduce the melting temperature of iron by hundreds of degrees. But the study is only up to a few, like 10 GPa or so. But then there are people who measured the iron hydride, how the velocity and density would change when you incorporate hydrogen into iron. Hydrogen is particularly difficult to study because it's very difficult to detect hydrogen. They are so light. So when you try to use X-ray to detect hydrogen, it's very difficult. With neutron diffraction, you can learn more about hydrogen, but the neutron diffraction usually require a very, very large sample that doesn't allow you to go to really high pressure. So I think hydrogen is maybe the least understood or least studied system among the major candidates of light elements in the core. Yes?
Frivolous point to end on, but you started off by saying there'd been speculation early on about the existence of a core.
Yes.
And of course, the reference is Edwin Halley, his, I think, 1702 paper. And I recommend all students here, or everyone who's early in their career here, read that paper. It was published in Philosophical Transactions, so you can download it as a PDF. And it's Edwin Halley, the But if you read that paper, apart from his interest in religion, and what he actually did was he predicted that the interior of the Earth was mobile because of the moving, the changes he'd observed in the magnetic field. So it's actually is the genuine first scientific argument for it. But the paper is just so nicely written in a modern way. So I think I would suggest anyone have a look at that paper and see if you can emulate the English, the standard of English in it, and see if you can write something that sounds good in 300 years' time.
Maybe we can upload it to BSpace.
I can do that for you if you like.
Great.
He was trying to get into a chair at Oxford at the time, so the religion, I think, is supposed to be related to that. But it's basically the result of his marine surveys of magnetic fields in the Earth.
But prior to that, people must have thought about the presence of the core, right? Do we know the moment of inertia before? I think we should. I don't know. Because usually you look at the moment of inertia factor, you can infer a dense region inside. And if you look at the density, you can also...
But the moment of inertia we know from remote sensing.
Yeah, what was the earliest measurements of moment of inertia? That was probably 1800s during navigation.
Right.
Navigational tool.
Right. So that's before. That's before the.
Yeah. Rocks. Rocks.
Right. Okay. Yes.
Early on, I've been talking about phase changes at different compositions. You mentioned you can have two or three different phases existing at the same time.
Yes. Yes.
Would those reside as adjacent different crystals at different compositions and phases, or would they be all kind of mixed up and undetectable as some kind of average?
That's a good question. It depending on how the phase transition happens, and also depending on the history, how long this two phase have been coexisting for a while. If it just, when you have one phase break down into two, usually there's grain size reduction. And then, for instance, iron silicon, there was a paper a few years ago saying if iron silicon is in the inner core, it's going to coexist as two phases. A BCC phase and then HCP phase. But these two phases, you are asking whether they have a large enough grain size for us to see, or whether they are just mixed in fine grains. I would imagine that the grain sizes are pretty large, because usually the metallic system, the grain growth is relatively fast. And if you have been sitting at a more or less uniform like a temperature for a long time, you would be able to grow into large phases. Whether they can impinge on the boundary, I can only speculate. I don't know. That's a good question. We always ask this question about the grain size in the Earth's interior, and we don't really know much about what's the grain size. If you look at the xenoliths, maybe the lower mantle has millimeter size grains. And then once I remember talking to somebody who studied rheology about the core, and then his answer is 1 meter. 1 meter is, I don't know, for seismology, it's not very much, right?